I've been hosting this interview show for 17 years, and I've always been guided by the belief that empowering conversations are important first steps to avoiding the worst effects of climate change. But I'll admit that every now and again, I wonder why talking is so important.
Yeah, like, is having conversations even enough?
I'm Greg Dalton.
I'm Ariana Brocious.
And this is Climate One. As heat waves, storms, droughts, and wildfires continue to worsen, talking can seem seriously insufficient. What effect does it really have? Are we just engaged in blah, blah, blah? Just this week, a guest wrote to me that talk is meaningless without action. I hear that a lot. We need action, not talk.
Right, I get that, and I agree. But real conversations are one of our best ways to share information and express why this stuff matters in our lives right now. And it can inspire others to think differently about something. All of those things are necessary first steps that, hopefully, lead to change and action.
Well, then the question becomes, how do we turn hopefully into something more real? How do we make those conversations really count?
Right, those are excellent questions, and that's exactly what we're going to talk about on today's show. We're going to explore the power of conversation by revisiting some of our own great conversations. One of our favorite climate communicators is Catherine Hayhoe. She's an internationally renowned climate scientist who is also both chief scientist at the Nature Conservancy and a professor in the Department of Political Science at Texas Tech.
She is a powerhouse, a real rock star. The reason I like her so much is her ability to explain and connect at the same time. She's a scientist devoted to hard metrics who also champions the power of conversations and connection.
When you spoke to her in 2021, you talked about how one reason people avoid talking about climate is because they don't want to engage in conflict.
Yeah, she has all kinds of strategies for connecting with people who disagree with her. And even still, she gets hateful messages from total strangers all the time.
Well, I get these messages every day. Today was a bit on the high side, so I've had at least 25 today. Most days I get one or two. And they come from dismissives. They come from people who, my personal definition, which I probably mentioned to you before, Greg, people who, if an angel from God with brand new tablets of stone saying global warming is real appeared before them, it would not change their minds. So why would I think I could? So I don't start a conversation to argue. And if somebody argues with me, I respond once. And if they continue to argue rather than using the resources I provided, I'm done. I step out. Because if we begin a conversation by disagreeing over something, it is very rare. It's not impossible, but it is rare for it to end in a positive direction. But here's how we can flip it on its head. If we begin a conversation from the heart rather than the head, if we begin a conversation with something we agree on rather than something we disagree on, if we begin a conversation by esteeming the other person rather than implicitly judging them as so many conversations begin today, that conversation starts off with so much potential and can end in an incredibly surprising place.
Before the conversation even starts, Hayhoe thinks deeply about how to find common ground with the other person based on their values. She told me about the first time she spoke at a Rotary Club in Texas.
I had carefully prepared a presentation that connected with who people were and where they lived. So I talked all about Texas because we all lived in Texas. But I walked in and I see this giant banner, you know, up in the lobby that says the four-way test. Is it the truth? Is it fair? Is it beneficial to all concerned? And I looked at this, I thought, that's climate change. Is it the truth? Yes. Is it fair? Absolutely not. That's why I'm a climate scientist. It's the most profoundly unfair thing. And it exacerbates all the other injustices too. Would it benefit people to fix it? Yes. So I skipped the buffet lunch. I went and perched on a seat in the corner of the hotel ballroom. I got my laptop and I rearranged my presentation into the four-way test. So I got up there and I could see a few people giving some side eye to the woman who'd invited me. Like, we know what you did there and you're not going to get on this committee again. It was what those looks were seeming to say to her. And there was a lot of sort of folded arms and leaning back, you know, I'm just going to give her this time because that's what we do, but I'm not going to agree. But then I started in with the four-way test. And so immediately those were their values and I was esteeming their values so much that I was basing everything I was saying around the test and applying their test to what I had to say. And I went through the four-way test and I could see the arms unfolding. I could see, you know, people leaning forward. I could see people even starting to nod. And at the end, I will never forget, a local banker who I had met before a couple of times came up to me with the most bemused look on his face. And he said, "I never thought too much of that whole global warming thing," which is the very polite Texan way of saying I thought it was a load of crap, "but it passed the four-way test. In other words, what can I do? That's my value system. It tested it. It passed. I gotta agree." That is the incredible power of starting not with our own values and our own priorities and our own sense of what is right, but recognizing everybody has morals. Everybody has values. Everybody has reasons why they make decisions. And if we take the time to get to know them, most times they are values we can esteem. They are priorities that we can respect. And if we connect climate change to what they already care about, immediately we're talking on their terms, not ours.
That's such a powerful story, and it really gets at something else. The other half of talking is listening. Catherine Hayhoe really takes the time to listen, to get to know her audience first, before she tries to convey new information.
Yeah, it's easy to fall into this trap where we think providing information is going to change people's minds.
An information dump. Mm-hmm.
Right. Someone who spent a lot of time practicing the craft of good listening is the journalist Meera Subramanian. And she told me identity politics has gotten in the way of reaching each other.
People really do have strong identities to their place and to their communities, to their people that they care about. And a lot of times I think that a lot of the boundaries and the friction that we're experiencing now are just where there seems like there's clashing, but there often is actually ways that we could be finding more overlap there.
So we're not listening to each other.
We're not listening to each other at all. And we're not listening to each other, what each other is listening to either, with the media silosization that's happened, right?
Right, right. So how do you get people to listen to you, and how do you listen to them?
So much of what has been explored around talking about climate change is that people aren't listening to why people either care about it deeply, are very much against it and don't want to believe that it's happening, or are in the place in between, which is where many Americans are, where they're just busy doing other things, or they feel intimidated by the science. There's just so many reasons why people might be resistant or engaged or dismissive. And when I've been out reporting, sometimes I'm seeking out people that are on certain sides of the spectrum. But what I often find is that both sides are not listening to each other. I think it's really easy for people on the climate activist side to completely and utterly dismiss the people who are skeptical, and vice versa. And so I think going in and trying to understand what is driving somebody, what are they thinking about in the middle of the night? Because everybody's kind of up in the middle of the night, I think, especially these days.
I am. So, yeah. For sure.
So what are those driving concerns? What are they worried about? And I think where the opportunity is that there's so many places where addressing climate change can address those midnight worries for everybody. And that sometimes means that you have to let go of, you know, going back to identity, letting go of your own story about why a topic concerns you and listening to what somebody is saying about why it might concern them.
Yeah, there's sort of this immediate rebuttal. We pounce on each other without really absorbing or reflecting. And there's often a lot of fear, I think, underneath the
right. And what happens with that? I mean, psychologists tell us, and we all know, we all get our defenses up when we feel attacked. It's just a human response. And so we have to hold ideas and facts accountable. There has to be accountability around what is actually happening on the scientific level. But just beating people over the head with that is not the way that narrative changes.
What I hear Meera Subramanian saying there is that if the science alone was enough to convince people, we would have prevented the worst of human-caused climate change decades ago.
Exactly. Facts and evidence hasn't gotten the job done. It's not like this was a big surprise. Scientists have been presenting business leaders and government officials with the basic facts for a long, long time.
A long time.
President Lyndon Johnson was briefed on climate change in 1965, and he made some really strong statements about the harms of burning fossil fuels.
And this reminds me of another person who's focused on communicating science, Faith Kearns. She actually wrote a whole book about this, and she believes one of the big pitfalls is thinking that the point of talking is to present information.
That's right. She's all about speaking from the heart. She told me about an awakening she had in 1996 when she went to the National Press Club to hear a group of UN climate scientists present their report.
The presentation was not particularly dynamic. It was, these are the facts as they are, and now we shall proceed to do something about it. Mm. And I think as a young person, I had learned about things like how we dealt with acid rain and the ozone hole. And so I sort of knew that it was possible to develop these kinds of agreements, arrangements, diplomatic efforts that would address these issues. And I, at the time, assumed climate change would be very similar. Mm. And there was nothing, you know, the day I watched this report being released that would indicate otherwise. But the past 25 years of my career have certainly shown me otherwise.
Right. In fact, Jim Hansen says when he testified in 1988 that the hot summer before Congress, really when the New York Times published that front page article, that's in many ways, that's when the public discourse of climate began. He thought that the responsible parties would receive the facts and do the responsible thing. And we've taken us a couple of decades to learn that human beings are not quite as rationally responsive as we all expected.
That has also changed for me how I think of communicating as a scientist. So, you know, when I was younger, the way that we would talk about communicating science was often that you would, you know, learn how to speak really well, give a good presentation, come up with bullet message points that you would deliver to journalists, hopefully at the New York Times. And you would hopefully be speaking from a position of tenure at Stanford or some other elite institution. And I think as we both know, none of those things are quite as useful as we might have hoped. And instead, what I've found with myself is I've had to turn to other professions that have a longer history of working directly with people on very sort of emotional, contentious, and traumatizing issues, which is what many of these environmental related issues have become.
So much of climate communication is based on this deficit model of communication. Can you tell us what the deficit model is? And is it still kind of the main primary model for that people are operating on?
Yeah. So the deficit model is basically this idea that in order to take action, essentially, or to do something, people just need more information. This is not particular to the sciences. I've worked for a large environmental NGO where a lot of the focus was on the idea of awareness, right? Everybody's trying to figure out how do we move past this idea that just arming people with facts will lead to a better world. Right, because we've just seen that that's absolutely not true. But science communication in many ways evolved from faculty who were used to teaching, right? And so you can't say that you don't think that teaching model is helpful when you're very deeply invested in it, right? Mm-hmm. And so we've had this reckoning where people, I think, realize that even that teaching model doesn't work as well as people had hoped. And so, you know, I think this is a broad scale reckoning about how we work together. And I think what's more helpful for me, rather than sort of sitting there as somebody who says, I know what we need to do, and now I just need to get everybody else to do it, which to me is a lot of the focus of the behavior change psychology piece, is actually to say, we're all facing this sort of same dilemma, and I know a few things, and you know a few things. What are we going to do?
Sounds like you're really talking about empathy with the audience, and you came to that place through some tough lessons. As a young scientist, you spoke to a group about fire science in an academic way without acknowledging that you were talking to fire survivors in a way that was re-traumatizing to them. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so about 2007, I was with some colleagues up in Ukiah, Northern California, and we were participating in something called a fire safety demonstration where, you know, a couple times a year you might go out to a fairgrounds or something like that and sort of talk with people about how you can keep homes from burning down during wildfires by doing things like making sure your attic vents are covered with screens that embers can't get through and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so what we didn't realize that day was that we were talking to a community that had just survived a wildfire, and they were dealing directly with many of the issues that we were talking about in a fairly intellectually distanced way. For example, how to maybe stay and protect your home during a wildfire, right? Which is clearly an incredibly emotional issue. And then, you know, just talking about what people can do to make sure they're prepared to evacuate, I think brought up varying feelings for people. You know, some people were really grateful that they'd been able to do it, and other people had guilt about things they'd left behind. There were just a lot of emotions in the room. And it was the first time that I let myself kind of really feel that as a scientist and not assume that it was something that I wasn't going to contend with, right? And so part of that was because a man came up to me afterward, and he basically shared with me in not using these words, in words that took me many years afterward to figure out what he was saying, but he had said, "Your presentation re-traumatized me and made me, you know, rethink how I had dealt with this fire and things like that." And I did spend a year or two really thinking a lot about that conversation, and it really reset my entire career to kind of try to understand how I could work on an issue like fire that has such direct meaning in people's lives in a way that wasn't so intellectually distanced. And what would it mean to be a scientist trying to do that? Because in many ways, we are very much encouraged to stay neutral, quote unquote, objective, and not let feelings get involved in the things that we're doing.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's rational. You stay up in your head. I'd like to talk about showing emotions in the process of communicating. You relate a story of Harvard historian Naomi Oreskes arguing that scientists should demonstrate alarm when they are using alarming language. Say more about that episode.
Dr. Oreskes just wrote this really, she's written a couple of things about this idea that, you know, scientists are saying, it's similar to the fire story I was saying, right? They're saying these very alarming things, but in tones that aren't like, "There's smoke, everybody evacuate." You know, it's very monotone, kind of like the apocalypse is coming, but nobody worry. And I think the disconnect between those two things has been very, very difficult in the sciences. And I think we're still figuring it out. And the thing that I try to get across a lot when I'm talking about this is that I'm really not talking about instigating feelings in other people. What I'm talking about is really just contending with the emotion that is already there. So what does it mean to really say to people, "This place that you live is going to be largely uninhabitable in 15 years. And to know how frightening that is to people while you're not outside of it. You may not live on that strip of land, but you see it, you experience it, whether it's from fire, from sea level rise, from groundwater contamination. So just these deep experiences of seeing what's coming, needing to communicate that, needing to work with other people's emotions and your own all at the same time, and having no training to do it, right? So I think that's where the old sort of dialogue about science communication has really fallen short, is just that we are dealing with tremendous problems. And it isn't so much a matter of just, let me move the chess pieces of who lives where and who does what and, you know, all of these things. We're just all in it together.
That was science communicator Faith Kearns. Today's show is all about the power of having conversations and how those conversations can inspire action. Coming up, when we talk about climate, are we focused on the wrong things?
Where's the space for delight in the climate? Why aren't we telling people all the cool shit that they're gonna have when we finally save the Earth?
We'll be right back.
Please help us get people talking more about climate by sharing this episode with a friend. And we'd like to know what you think of the show. Please give us a rating or review. You can do it right now on your device, and it really helps people find the show. Thanks. Today we're talking about talking. Why talking climate is important, and how to do it more effectively.
When you say effectively, what do you mean? like effective at conveying information or effective at persuading others to your point of view?
That's an excellent question. Effective at what? What is effectiveness? I used to think my job was conveying information. Now I think the point of talking is more about forming connections and building mutual empathy and understanding. My thinking on this was highly influenced by hearing David Brooks talk about his most recent book, How to Know a Person, The Art of Seeing Others and Being Deeply Seen. The way Brooks sees it, every exchange either builds or damages trust. And that made me reflect on how I talk about climate. Sometimes I'm in transmission mode and not really understanding my conversation partner.
I like that idea of transmission mode. I can totally see it. And I know I do that too, where you sort of get on your little soapbox, especially when you feel like you know a lot about something. And obviously, we both spend a lot of time talking about climate. But I like the idea that trust is established in subsequent conversations. And so maybe once a strong connection exists, there's more space for both sides to consider the other's viewpoint or their other argument more openly. And actually, a lot of skillful politicians and activists use those tactics in service of persuasion.
Right. The journalist and political analyst Anand Giridharadas has thought a lot about this. He wrote a book called The Persuaders, At the Front Lines of the Fight for Hearts, Minds, and Democracy. It explores how the tactics of persuasion can actually foster positive societal change.
This is not a book about how can we all get along better, how can we heal. It is a book about how do we save the country from very real threats, whether it's climate, internal fracturing, democratic decay, disgusting wealth inequality that has, you know, made the American dream something that only exists outside of the United States, and so forth. But what I'm interested in is how do we grow the support for those ideas and not write people off preemptively as being unaddressable, uninterested, stuck in their ways, never going to come around. How do we actually champion ideas like universal healthcare, or ideas like everyone voting and having those votes protected, or ideas close to your heart around how do we defend the planet from the threat of it being uninhabitable? How do we do those things in a way that is through joyful, magnanimous, fiery movements, movements that don't just feel dour, right? And we should talk in climate in particular. I think there's been this problem of movements that are better at being right than they are at being sticky, right? To me, and I'm an outsider of the climate world, but I will say the biggest problem with regard to climate on this topic of persuasion is the movement has been right on the facts, right on the warnings, right on the what needs to be done, right on the urgency, right on the shaming of politicians, right. I think somewhere down the line, no one got the memo to make sure that we are building a movement that is more fun, more life-giving, more purpose-giving, more educative, more welcoming to be part of, so that even if you don't care about 2 degrees this or 2 degrees that, or you don't like the fact that they're trying to get rid of your car or whatever, you just want to be part of where that's going. You want to be part of that thing. And what I want with this book is for more of the righteous causes in this country and around the world to think about, are we reaching people? Are we connecting to people emotionally and psychologically? Are we building that bigger we? Or are we just simply too complacent in the fact that our facts and our policies are correct?
Right. And you write about how some of those righteous movements can be exclusive and arrogant, whereas some of the what you consider less righteous are actually more welcoming and inclusive. So talk about that dichotomy.
It's so interesting, right? If you think about the far right in this country, which is now the right, if you think about what it wants on paper, the kind of program it's committed to, it is as exclusionary as kind of any major movement we've seen in our lifetime. It is devoted to stripping women of their rights, devoted to stripping people of color of their rights, devoted to keeping more people out of the country, devoted to making life harder for those on the margins of power. But if you think, if you separate the program, the agenda, what it wants on paper, from its kind of effective approach to voters, its political tactic, the way it is read by a lot of people in a political arena, it reads as like, come as you are, everyone in, this is fun, let's do this thing. And if you look at the left, broadly speaking, by contrast, the program is the most inclusive program, I would argue, without exaggeration, I think, the most inclusive program offered in the history of humankind, right? I mean, we're the left is talking about every expression of humanity being welcome, being celebrated, being legally protected, right? But then if you look at the way the left reads to a lot of people, the left reads to many people as being a club that's hard to join.
Mm-hmm.
You got to know the right terms. You got to say the right things. You have to kind of do your education on your own time and then come in, right? If we don't fix that, we are handing the country to those who wish it very ill.
I think that happens in climate a lot, where if you're not vegan and solar, you're kind of looked down upon. There's this sort of, you know, purity test in climate world, like that sort of judges people about their greenness, and that can, people can sense that, and it
totally
can be off-putting.
So if you got meat eaters in your climate movement, that means your movement is now reaching people who don't share all your convictions, who don't share everything, but they still like something about what you're saying. You probably even alienated them sometimes with some of your vegan stuff, but they're still there. Why are they there? That's interesting. Why are they showing up? You have created something in them that they still want to be there in spite of the barrier. Hallelujah. Congratulations. Now you got a
welcome.
Movement.
Welcome. Welcome. Yeah, welcome. So I was curious about how you can welcome someone while also still being a persuader.
What I think predominates on the left is you start with the wares that you're trying to sell. I'm trying to sell you climate legislation. I'm trying to sell you democracy legislation. I'm trying to sell you advanced manufacturing legislation. I'm trying to sell you infrastructure legislation. And you, the voter, may be standing over there being like, I'm really concerned about rising prices. I feel my neighborhood is unsafe. And I feel like the broad approach of the left is like, no, you're overblowing this inflation. It's fine. It's just the war in Ukraine. Like, you're overblowing the inflation. This crime thing is not real. The stats, if you actually run the regression another way, it's not actually more unsafe. What you're feeling is not real, right? And people are like, I don't know. I saw two people got shot outside my street. I kind of don't like that. It's like, no. If you actually compare it year on year, adjusted for population growth, you're totally safe.
We've got white papers that say da da da.
So many white papers. And like, you know, would you like to reorganize the entire economy to fight climate change? Like, I'm really concerned about like inflation and crime. Like, well, climate is so important. Like, that's actually the issue that matters right now. And you know, what about infrastructure? I'd love to build some infrastructure. Like, yeah, I can't afford my house. Like, yeah, but we need infrastructure, you know? And it's not that these policies are not the right policies, because as you know, they actually do address a lot of these issues, and they do save you money in different ways, and they do create jobs that will help you afford your house, right? But I just feel like, very broadly speaking, the posture of the left is like, yeah. I know you feel that stuff's important, but let me explain to you why, in fact, this other stuff is more important, or is like primary. Like, if you don't care about stuff we care about, then the stuff you're worried about like won't happen. That's often the argument. Okay, now pivot to the right. The right starts with, what's going on with you? What's happening with you, Greg? What are you anxious about? What are you afraid about? What have you noticed in your town recently that made you go, huh? That's new. What did your kids come home and say to you about what they learned in school that made you feel a little bit destabilized because you didn't learn that thing in school, and that seems maybe a little weird what they learned or off-putting. What trainings have you been going to at work, Greg, that made you feel like, oh, I don't know, I feel kind of awkward in those trainings, or I feel attacked in those trainings? The right is starting with you.
Relationship.
And I think when we do not do that on the left, we get to a place where we're almost condescending to voters about what they should be caring about, instead of saying, who are you? What are you afraid of? And how can I, you know, how can I serve that? And so something like climate is such a prime example, because it's the difficulty of climate for most people who are not, who do not experience it as a day-to-day issue right now. Maybe they should, but most voters who are not, it is not polling at 1, 2, or 3.
Right, right.
I think there is a basic problem of saying it should be polling at 1, 2, or 3. Right? Why are you not caring about this? Don't you get
what's
how
wrong
important
with it? Yeah, right, right.
As opposed to like, what do you love? You love your kids? You think about legacy? You love things being affordable? What do you love? And so, you know, instead of saying it's annoying that that's not a top three issue, I think the way we often feel it's annoying that people are not getting it. How do we build consciousness around that issue? You know? And so just some thoughts. I think there's a way in which fighting climate has often been framed as something that feels like homework, or feels like eating your broccoli or spinach. It just feels heavy. It doesn't, you know, and I think
it's complicated. It's complicated. It's depressing.
Correct. Yeah. And I think it's worth saying very clearly that there is no intrinsic reason why that needs to be the dominant affect of fighting climate change. I think it's actually preposterous that that's the dominant thing. Is there a dour element to it? Is there a you can't have this anymore element? Sure. But as someone else, I think Bill McKibben was saying on Twitter, like, fighting climate also means blimps. We're going to have blimps going all around, helium blimps carrying you around. And he wrote a piece about, like, where's the delight? Where's the space for delight in the climate? Why aren't we telling people all the cool shit that they're going to have when we finally save the earth, right? Why aren't we talking about the fact that we're finally going to make Black communities whole in a bunch of structural and infrastructural ways after 400 years of plunder? Climate is the only thing big enough to rewire enough things to deal with that legacy. Why aren't we talking about how awesome transit is going to be all around the country? Why aren't we, like, hiring architects to invent incredible futuristic sustainable homes and build them at scale for the masses, and making it easier to build homes instead of having to, you know, beg and borrow and steal from your local, you know, zoning authority to build something clean and green in your home? Like, there's no reason, intrinsic reason, that climate is like, you can't eat beef anymore, and you're like, you know, and you're not going to be able to, like, you can't. There's no, that's, it's very weird that we've allowed that to become the dominant framing.
Yeah, stop, don't, bad. Yeah, it's all very, the framing where the electric cars are great. Anyone who's driven an electric car knows that it's inherently better, faster, more enjoyable than an internal combustion car. You'd say that most people are failing as persuaders. What can people do to be better persuaders?
I think there's a whole bunch of things you can do. I think you can learn to listen better and more strategically, not for kumbaya, but for actually achieving results in moving people. The climate movement needs to, you know, stop trying to hawk a dour sounding agenda and actually start with, where are people? Meet people where they are. Where are they on the emotional level? Where are they psychological level? How can we speak to them? And finally, I would say, whether this is folks listening worrying about their climate change denying uncle, or worrying about this at a more systemic scale, I think it's important to recognize that a very large number of voters, of citizens, of our relatives and friends, are morally confused. They are, as Beyonce describes of herself, they're contradicted, right? They agree that the planet is beautiful, but they don't like pressure on small business to save the planet. They agree that Black people have it harder in this country, but they don't like the government playing favorites on race and, you know, having race-conscious politics. Like, they just feel contradicted. The persuaders I wrote about get that people are contradicted and orient themselves toward building up that element in people that might compete with the other thing that is right now their outward stance. Your outward stance is against immigration. Your outward stance is let's do nothing on climate. But there's another part in you. It may be your Christianity and your idea of God's creation of the earth. There's a kind of B-side in people's hearts on virtually every issue. The B-side is small in some cases. It's almost near as influential as the A-side in other cases. But we all kind of have a B-side for the things we think, at least many of us, enough of us to drastically change the course of this country. And the biggest thing I think you could take away from these persuaders I got to spend time with over the last few years is to recognize that view of other people as complicated as you know yourself to be, and then engage, whether interpersonally, in your family, in politics, engage in that work of helping them make it make sense, helping them make meaning, and be there to walk with them in the direction that you wish to go.
That was Anand Giridharadas. His book is called The Persuaders, At the Front Lines of the Fight for Hearts, Minds, and Democracy. And I really love what he says there about recognizing the view of other people as complicated as you know yourself to be. We all contain multitudes, right? And starting from there is probably a better way to get into real conversation with others.
He also says most people are 60-40 on most issues. That is to say, while we have core beliefs, much of what we think is dependent on context, who we're talking with, what we read recently, how we're feeling that day. Our views have fluidity. We don't think and feel the same way all the time. That explains why, if we want to change how people think in an enduring way, it's so critical to engage with them over time. One-off conversations don't define or change people. Relationships do. They help form a lasting way of seeing and being in the world.
One person who really put that into practice is Chloe Maxman. Maxman was the youngest woman to ever serve in the Maine State Senate. She's a Democrat, and after a 2-year term in the State House, she was elected to the State Senate in 2020, unseating a 2-term Republican incumbent.
Maxman and her former campaign manager co-wrote a book called Dirt Road Revival. In it, they described their non-traditional approach to on-the-ground campaign strategy. They knocked on doors and then went back to talk to those same people again. Most political organizers don't return for follow-ups. She also writes that Democrats often look down on rural people.
I've definitely always heard these narratives of, these rural folks, they're voting against their own self-interest. And, you know, what are they doing? And, you know, kind of these narratives that portray rural folks as not really understanding the issues and undermining their own best future. Those narratives have been very, very loud to me when I've been in urban spaces and even sometimes progressive spaces. I think it's just it's a narrative that makes it really hard for us to engage with rural folks. And in my experience, knocking doors in my district, I've knocked over 20,000 doors in my community. You know, that narrative has had an actual impact on the ground where folks think Democrats don't want to hear from me. They don't want to take the time to talk to me. They just look down on me. They think they're better than I am. And so why would I vote for a Democrat?
Right. And having spent time in places like Montana and New Hampshire, I've felt how people in those areas can feel the judgment of coastal elites. And in your book, Dirt Road Revival, you write, quote, things move at the speed of relationships in rural America. You don't jump straight into business and take care of things as quickly as possible, end quote. How were you able to use that idea in your campaigning?
To us, it really felt quite simple. You know, when we were having these conversations with folks, many of whom had never been contacted by a Democratic campaign or canvasser in their entire voting history, we, both myself, my campaign manager, all of our volunteers, we didn't show up and say, hey, this is Chloe. This is who she is. Are you going to vote for her? Yes or no? Do you know where your polling place is? Yes or no? We didn't bring a traditional campaign script into the situation. What we did was we showed up and we said, hey, you know, we're from Chloe's campaign, or, you know, I'm Chloe, just stopping by to see what's on your mind and how we can best represent what's going on in your life. So it was really about building relationships with folks. You know, I always think of it as just, you know, like making a friend 101. You don't show up, especially on someone's doorstep, on their porch, in their kitchen, and say, hey, you want to argue about abortion with me? You show up and you say, hey, I'd love to get to know you, find out where our common ground is, and let's see if we can build a relationship from there.
How do you handle conversations with conservatives when they express opinions that are antithetical to your own beliefs or even offensive?
That's such a good question, and it's something that took me a long time to find my own answer to. I think I found a lot of space in myself to have conversations with people where we can agree to disagree, and we can have very civil, kind, insightful conversations, even if we're coming out on opposite sides. And I think that's a really lost art that's so important for maintaining some sense of empathy in our political environment when that's becoming very, very difficult. And of course, sometimes people say things that I don't agree with or that I find offensive, you know, and I found my own way to kind of talk back to that, ask questions about it, understand where it's coming from. So it's not something that completely ends a conversation. You know, I've heard so many people say that they just kind of expect liberals and Democrats to yell at them and to school them on what's right and wrong when it comes to certain issues. You know, there have definitely been so many times when people say things that are just too offensive for me to engage with. And at that point, I say, thank you so much for your time. I don't think we don't have much to talk about here. I'm going to move on with my day. Thanks for talking. My approach is not to argue with anyone, not to try to persuade anyone, but just trying to listen and understand what I'm hearing.
And people use different language. I'm curious how you chose your words and if you used words to reflect back to people that I'm using your word, or at least which shows kind of I understand you, or I'm not using that other word that those other people use.
One of the biggest epiphanies that I had while doing this work is that so much of the time we completely align on values, but there are buzzwords or policies or just other things that are really divisive and prevent the conversation from happening. So really being able to focus on that deeper level of values was, you know, almost always there was space for a conversation there, even if there wasn't agreement. And I think that was so important. You know, it's about translating this work into a rural conservative context. And I mean, it makes sense. We don't use the same language wherever we go. People don't communicate the same way in every state or in every community. And so it also doesn't make sense that we would have like a one size fits all approach to campaigning or talking about the Green New Deal or Medicare for All or, you know, lowering student debt. Those conversations require a different dialect in rural communities like mine. But every single person in this country is impacted by the climate crisis. Everyone in Maine right now, every farmer is dragging because there is no rain. And that's the way that we talk about it and think about it here. And people are going to talk about it and think about it in different ways in different places. It sounds so cheesy, but you know, I feel like I've learned this lesson from listening to so many folks who are different from me and also being in so many democratic spaces that are pretty rigid about how we think about these issues. We just got to have open hearts and open minds.
That was Chloe Maxman. After serving in the Maine State Senate, she decided not to run for re-election. Maxman said she thought she could have more impact by working to get many people elected rather than just focusing on her own political career. Now she's co-executive director at Dirt Road Organizing. Coming up, climate activists aren't the only ones pulling the levers of communication to get people to their side. Deniers and delayers also have their own playbook.
If we want a public who are resilient against misinformation, we need to build up their ability to spot these types of fallacies.
How to spot and counter misleading information while remaining in conversation. That's up next when Climate One continues.
And we're live on match day as Doug reaches for a buffalo wing. He's got it. Oh, and he's gone for a can of Pepsi too. What a finish. There's no doubt about it. It just tastes better. Match days deserve Pepsi.
So far today, we've talked about tools for how to listen better and build connections, and also ways that persuasion can lead to a stronger society. But there's a challenge that many of us run into when we start to talk about climate. What do you do when the person you're chatting with is really dug in on a climate myth? Greg, how do you handle that?
Sometimes well, sometimes not well. I try not to attack the myth directly, and I do try to connect through something we have in common: technology, faith, money, food, something. I also turn to what I've learned from people like John Cook. He's a senior research fellow at the Melbourne Center for Behavior Change. His research focuses on how we can use critical thinking to build resilience when we're faced with misinformation. To do that, we first have to learn how to spot the tactics used by deceivers and understand their goals.
Ultimately, its goal is to delay climate action and maintain the status quo. And you'll find that no matter what the argument is, the conclusion is always the same. Whether they're arguing climate change isn't real, therefore we shouldn't act, or climate change isn't caused by humans, therefore we shouldn't act, or solutions won't work, therefore we shouldn't act. It's always that end thing.
Right, which harkens that confusion and doubt.
There has been a gradual shift. Now they're arguing against climate solutions, arguing that climate policy might be harmful, arguing that renewables won't work, and just more subtle arguments than the usual climate change is a hoax type misinformation.
Right. That's no longer tenable in a world where there's floods and fires that are rampant.
I think what's most potent right now is culture war type misinformation, arguments that other people who care about climate change, who are trying to get climate action, painting them as different to us, and they're trying to take away our lifestyle or impinge on our freedom, and generally just trying to make the climate issue more tribal. The more tribal and polarized it becomes, the harder it is to get progress.
And some of the techniques employed by misinformation you cite are magnified minority, cherry picking, false dichotomy. How are those employed? And give some examples of each one if you could.
So attacking the scientific consensus on climate change has been a common strategy over the last few decades. And one way to do that is the use of magnified minority. In other words, take a small group and make them look much bigger than they actually are and much more significant than they really are. And the most popular version of this technique is the Global Warming Petition Project. This is a website that features 31,000 science graduates in the US who've signed a statement saying that humans aren't disrupting climate. And the point of this website is to say, hey, look, 31,000 people dissent against the consensus that proves that there isn't a scientific consensus. But when you look at the total number of science graduates in the US, it's millions and millions. And 31,000, while seeming like a big number, is actually a tiny fraction of a percent. It's magnifying a minority to make them look bigger than they really are.
Mm-hmm. So policy is harmful. What's that attack?
Usually arguing that climate policy is harmful takes a form of arguing that it's either going to ruin the economy or raise prices for people. Typically what this does is cherry picks or oversimplifies the policy. For example, this is a very Australian-centric one, but it's the one that immediately comes to mind. We brought in a carbon price in order to send a signal to the market to transition from fossil fuels to renewables. And this carbon price generated revenue for the government, but all that money was then given back. And it was mainly given back to lower income families. But what the the misinformation targeting the policy did was say, this is putting a price on carbon. That's going to raise prices for families while ignoring that that money was going back to families. So usually attacks on climate policy will focus on one part of it, but ignore the entire policy and the aspects of it that make it work better.
And then false dichotomy, what's an example of that?
False dichotomy is when you're given two choices and you have to choose one of them, when both might be true, or maybe there's a third choice. And the most common example of this in climate change, and this is a little bit technical and complicated, but it's looking at the ice core record. When we look at ice cores going back hundreds of thousands of years, in Antarctic ice cores, we see that when temperature goes up, CO2 goes up afterwards by several hundred years, roughly. And what that tells us is temperature went up before the CO2. And climate deniers look at this and say, well, either temperature drives CO2 or CO2 drives temperature. You have to choose one or the other. But that's actually a false dichotomy because it's not a choice between one or the other. Both are actually true. Temperature does drive CO2. When it gets warmer, the ocean gives up CO2 into the atmosphere. And then when you have more CO2 in the atmosphere, that causes warming because it's a greenhouse gas. Put those two together and you get a reinforcing feedback.
John, you've also written about how people often substitute judgment about complex topics such as climate science with more simple judgments. How does that reliance on shortcuts fuel climate misinformation?
Yeah, it's important to recognize that all of us are hardwired to make decisions based on snap mental shortcuts. And generally, it serves us well. It's how we're able to escape a saber-toothed tiger jumping out of the bushes, or just immediate threats. The problem is in this modern world, sometimes those mental shortcuts can lead us astray, and it can also make us vulnerable to bad arguments or misinformation. And it's an unfortunate reality that the solution to this problem is critical thinking. We need to be able to get better at spotting misinformation and the spotting attempts to mislead us. What are those different fallacies? Is this argument a false dichotomy, or does it use magnified minority or cherry picking or other misleading techniques? If we want a public who are resilient against misinformation, we need to build up their ability to spot these types of fallacies.
Right. And I was watching some of your videos online of you kind of dissecting the premise and does the conclusion logically follow the premise. And it all seemed very reasonable. And I thought, yeah, but this is like bringing a knife to a gunfight. So I'm just curious about your sort of very reasoned approach, logic-based in an information age where things are viral and fake and spreading so quickly, regardless of their veracity.
Yeah, it's really hard. I've struggled with those thoughts and for many years. When we develop this critical thinking approach where you deconstruct arguments into premises and conclusion, I did that work with two critical thinking philosophers. They introduced me to the idea of parallel argumentation. You can explain logical flaws by not, you don't have to go into the whole premise, conclusion, logical, like, is it logically valid, all that kind of analysis. You can just take a flawed argument and transplant that logic into a parallel situation, usually the most absurd and extreme situation you can think of, and then use the same logic. And that makes it very clear and engaging and concrete when you're trying to explain the flawed logic to people. And when they introduced this technique to me, I realized that this was what late-night comedians use every night. They'll say, this person said this statement. And well, that's just like being in this situation and then using the same logic. Everyone laughs. They can immediately see that it's wrong and they're entertained. But most importantly, like the comedian has actually introduced a bit of critical thinking because it's shown a logical fallacy in a very concrete, engaging way.
So let's practice this. If I say that the climate's changed before, it's changing now, it's always been changing. Yeah, climate changes, that's what it does. How would you respond?
That argument is the same logic as saying, well, people have died of natural causes before cigarettes were invented. Therefore, cigarettes can't cause harmful effects. Or people have died of cancer long before cigarettes were invented. Therefore, smoking doesn't cause cancer. It's the same logic, and it commits single cause fallacy. In other words, saying that whatever caused something in the past must also be causing it now, when you can have multiple causes.
Let's try another one. If I say that models are unreliable, climate models, they're not accurate.
So actually, we're doing an experiment on that now. And so our approach has been to say models are a simplification of reality. They don't capture all of reality. And we use models to get astronauts to the moon. They're simplified versions of reality. Newton's laws of motion and Newton's laws of gravity are simplifications. Models don't need to be perfect in order to give us useful results. And climate models, they're not perfect. They don't capture absolutely everything, but they capture enough to tell us that humans are causing climate change and that climate change has serious impacts.
John Cook is based at the University of Melbourne. We've got a link to his work in our show notes at climateone.org. I find it so helpful to hear Cook break down the specific kinds of misinformation tactics and how to respond to them.
Agreed. And there's another resource for having conversations about climate that I want to mention. It's actually from a marketing firm called Potential Energy, focused on helping persuade and convince people to act on climate. They put out a guide called Talk Like a Human, which suggests words we can use to connect with people. And it actually gets very specific about why language matters and how we can shift the words we use to be more encompassing and communicate ideas more effectively. So, for example, they point out that the word green can actually be pretty loaded. It's political and broad and kind of vague. It's more effective to talk about safe and clean energy, or conservation and preservation. These are terms that more people can understand and get behind.
Yeah, and it also suggests focusing on the local human impacts. So instead of talking about the planet, which is an abstraction and a term used more by people on the left, talk about your state, your town, your kids. Make it real and personal.
And one more piece of advice from the guide that I really want to underline. There's no need to exaggerate. The truth of our situation is scary enough.
This hour on Climate One, we've been talking about the power of conversation, how to talk with others more effectively, and how it's a necessary first step that can lead to real change. We'd like to end today's episode with one more story from Catherine Hayhoe that really stuck with us.
It's a story that shows just how much individual conversations can have a far-ranging ripple effect.
In my book, I talk about a man called Glenn, who watched my TED Talk when it came out in December 2018. And then in May the following year, so like barely 6 months later, I was speaking near where he lived. And he took the train in to see me speak. And he said, I really wanted to come meet you because I've been worried about climate change for a long time. But after I heard your TED Talk in December, I decided I was going to talk about climate change in my town. So I started to have conversations with everyone I knew about climate change and why it mattered to us and what our town could do about it. And I've kept a record of those conversations. Would you like to see it? So I said, sure. This was a new one. So he reached in his leather satchel and he pulled out a sheaf of papers. And I was expecting maybe 70 or 80 names. Well, Glenn had tracked who everybody else had talked to too, because he got them to do it too. He now has over 12,000 names on his list. And after only 5 months, he had about 10,000 names. And within a year of starting that Have a Conversation About Climate Change campaign, his city council had voted to declare a climate emergency, and which is what they do in the UK. It was in the UK. And then they had voted to put £20 million, which is a considerable amount for a relatively small town, towards a climate action plan. And it all began with one man deciding to have conversations using his voice. I mean, if he could do that, imagine what the rest of us could do.
Talking about climate can be hard, and it's critical to address the transitions we need to make in all parts of society. Please help us get people talking more about climate and give us a sense of what you think of the show by giving us a rating or a review.
Brad Marshland is our senior producer. Our managing director is Jenny Park. Ariana Brocious is co-host, editor, and producer. Austin Cologne is producer and editor. Megan Basili is our production manager. Wensie Shade is our development manager, and our communications manager is Ben Testani. Jenny Lawton is consulting producer. Our theme music was composed by George Young. Gloria Duffy and Philip Yun are co-CEOs of the Commonwealth Club World Affairs, the nonprofit and nonpartisan forum where our program originates. I'm Greg Dalton.